welcome all. As I said, if anybody just came on board, we welcome guests at any time. The ROP Caesar Group, if you do want to join, it's only $20 a year. And now, through March 31st, if you join for $20, you will actually get 2 years for the price of the membership. And so details about that are on our website, as well as the link to join under the Join or Renew button at the top of our homepage. Okay, with that, I think that's all of the public service announcements, and so I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. I'll get right onto it. It is the season, and one of the things that happens in the season is that you start receiving all kinds of scam messages, and there's been a lot of media coverage in the all over the place about various scams, and some horror stories of elderly people who've lost hundreds of thousands of dollars in some cases. And I guess generally the scammers try to get you to believe that you can get double-digit returns, and you'll make all kinds of money on cryptocurrency, and their bank investigators, they're going to help you retain your money. I'm hoping that OPCUG members have read our Fraud Watch pages and looked at the examples with the red flags, and so everybody knows better about it. But they are coming in, and a couple of examples came in to a member recently. Canada Post, of course, everybody's expecting parcels from various sources, so here's Canada Post saying that an international parcel has arrived and payment is required. But if you look at the return address here, it's clear that tech.mx is not a Canada Post email address. So that seems highly unlikely. And then as you carry on and you find this big red button, pay the fees now, if you hover your mouse over that link, you'll find that it goes to me-qr.com, which clearly, again, is nothing to do with Canada Post. I put the big red flag over the URL because Chris says he doesn't want anybody to click on them, but we're all smarter than that, aren't we? If we keep going, we get an important security notice. And if you read it, it says, do not pay via links in unsolicited emails. Now, that's good advice. And then further on here, the address here, Riverside Drive, and the telephone number, the 866 number, are both correct. But if you put the tracking number into this Canada Post.track here, you remember on the previous slide, this slide right here, there's a tracking number right there. If you actually put that into the URL, you'll find that that is an incorrect tracking number. And in fact, this member called Canada Post, and it turns out that this pattern of alphanumeric coding doesn't follow the one that's required for Canada Post tracking numbers. So there's all kinds of red flags here. here's one that came supposedly from the Royal Bank. Again, if you hover the link, you'll find that the URL's got absolutely nothing to do with the Royal Bank. Another giveaway down here, I love this one. The Royal Bank at 123 Finance Avenue, Suite 400, City and Country. These scammers are not terribly smart. They can't even fill out the template properly. However, they are a bit sneaky. Here they're saying that having clicked on this link, the next time you log in, you may notice an updated interface. It may not look the same as it did on the real website. I wonder why that would be. And then this is the classic again. Access your account securely, and then they tell you that, well, RBC will never send you an email asking you to click a link. What's that thing right there in the underlined in blue? So again, check out our Fraud Watch page, and there's all kinds of neat examples, so that you can avoid all this stuff. And then there was a follow up to that in terms of when you have a service company do something for you, they often send you a computer survey. So some company does a job for you, and then you want to know how well they did. And the survey link doesn't go to the company. It's usually some kind of third-party information gathering system. And the member wants to know, is there a way to make sure it's safe, and does it relate to this actual interaction? And she hadn't heard about scams using customer survey, but they do in fact exist. My take is it's quite unlikely that a survey scam is going to arrive just after you've had some company in to do a job. And you can always call the company involved and see if they do send out surveys like that. Or as Chris points out, the other way to guarantee that it's safe is just don't answer the survey. And if you do get unsolicited surveys at any old time, then you'll probably see the usual stuff, the big red flags. You have to do something right now because it's a limited time offer. And they're going to give you all kinds of prizes if you just click on this link and fill out our survey. The scams are usually pretty easy. Okay, Chris, you've got something similar but kind of related, I guess.
Yeah, so we had this come into the suggestion box email address. So this person was getting pop-up messages on their Windows 10 machine that was all up to date, saying things like, all files have been encrypted, the systems are damaged. Sometimes the message was saying that it was from Norton. Sometimes it was saying it was from McAfee. So great variety of what was going on. They were getting pop-ups every few minutes, and it all mentioned a website with a suffix of co.in, which is the country code for India. Ran a quick scan with their virus scanner, and everything was fine. And they were sure it was a scam. They hadn't clicked on any links or downloaded anything, but they wanted to get rid of that continuously occurring message. So first off, for anybody who is on the call and doesn't know, it is a scam for sure. What they're trying to do is probably get you to click in the pop-up and try and get you to pay something, either to get encrypted files unencrypted or to pay for some software that will remove fictional infection on your PC. The main thing is don't click anywhere in the pop-up. You know, if you have a button that says OK, you know enough not to click on that. If you see a button that says cancel, don't click on it because it may mean okay as well. Clicking anywhere in the pop-up may mean okay and do something. So just avoid doing any sort of click on the window at all. Now, how do you get rid of it? If the pop-up window has its own icon on the taskbar, you should be able to right-click on the taskbar icon and choose the option to close window. And that you have with any application that is running that presents itself on the taskbar. If you get it as a separate icon on the taskbar, it means that it is not part of your browser session. So it's a separate program that is actually running on your PC. So let's take a look at what if it's part of the browser session. So if it's no separate icon, then it almost certainly is part of the browser session. So it's the browser that is causing the pop-up to come on your screen. First thing I would do is try a different browser. So if you get no pop-ups, then that's actually a good thing. It means that the problem is limited to your other browser. Try closing all your browsers and see if the pop-ups stop. And so you can force close all your browser sessions. So I suggest you close them normally, but I would always go to Task Manager anyways. So Control-Shift-Escape is the easiest way to load Task Manager. Go to the Processes tab, and then browse through all of the apps that are running on your PC. Look for any that are your browser, right-click on it, and then choose End Task. And there may be multiple subtasks that get shut down as well. So you want to go through any running browsers you have on your system. So if the pop-ups then stop, then you know that, okay, it was part of the browser pop-up, and so then you have to track down what's causing it within the browser. And there can be a couple of causes. The most likely is that you inadvertently agreed to allow notifications from a particular site. How you turn off notifications varies depending on the browser that you have. And I will paste all of this into the chat right now. So the Perplexity link there will actually show you how, in all the major browsers, how you would remove notifications. Then try the browser again, and if the pop-ups are gone, then almost certainly that was the cause. And the good news is your computer is not likely compromised through any other means if it's just that. If the pop-ups are still there, then because it's part of your browser session, then the other most likely culprit for it is a browser extension. So somehow you've gotten a browser extension in there that is causing the pop-ups, and you can get rid of those unknown extensions or any that look like they're malicious. I would probably go in and actually disable all the extensions in the browser, and the Perplexity link there tells you how to do that in each of the different major browsers. So disable all of them, see if the problem goes away, and if it does, then re-enable the ones that look like they're legitimate, get rid of any that look like they are ones you didn't put there and you don't want, and until you get to the point where you're not getting pop-ups, but you got back any of the browser extensions you really do want to have. So restart the browsers, and if the pop-ups are gone, then that was likely the cause. And again, good news is your computer is not likely compromised through any other means. If pop-ups are still there, what I would do is try resetting the browser to its default settings. Now, it's important that you actually look at this URL as well, because this tells you what happens when you reset your browser. And it may reset some things that you do not necessarily want reset. So take a look. So just going in with your eyes wide open on what will actually happen when you reset the browser. And it varies by browser. Some other things to check, and not really likely, but these are sort of things that if you suspect there's something going on weird on your computer, always good to choose these. First off, just do malware checks on your computer. And so you, hopefully, everybody here has antivirus installed on their computer. And even if you have something else installed on your computer, you can actually install any or all of these to run as an on-demand scan in addition to your normal antivirus, and all for free. So try them out. You can go through all of them or just a few of them, randomly go through a few of them, and just see if any of them pick up that you've got malicious software installed in your computer and eradicate it. And then I would check for unknown installed programs. So if you go to settings, all apps, installed apps, and just look through that list. And this is not a bad thing to do periodically. Just look through that list of things that you don't need, things that maybe you've installed them at one point and you no longer need them, you no longer use the program, why not uninstall it? It's just a potential security problem sitting there installed on your computer. If you don't use it, get rid of it. So always a good thing to go through that list periodically and clean it up. Make sure all your software is up to date. Now, if you're in Microsoft, anything from Microsoft should be updated by Windows Update. And it does a really, really good job. So I would say that the biggest thing with that is periodically do that manual check for updates, just to make sure that the Windows Update process itself isn't hosed. The only way they really tell that is to actually go into Settings, Windows Updates, check for updates, and see that it goes away, checks, comes back, and says, no, you're up to date. And for everything else, there's all kinds of third-party apps that don't do their own updating, and I would suggest that you install one or more free update or vulnerability managers. I use UniGet UI. I really like it. It's an update manager. It's not a vulnerability manager. It will tell you a newer version is available, not that it particularly fixes security vulnerabilities. It finds an awful lot of stuff that other updaters on my PC don't. Patch My PC Home Updater is another very good one. It finds some things that UniGet UI doesn't identify. Glarisoft Software Update is along the same lines as Patch My PC Home Updater. It does find some things that UniGet UI and Patch My PC Home Updater don't catch. So I periodically run both Patch My PC Home Updater and Glarisoft Software Updater just periodically to see if they're if they pick up anything extra. Secdir Vuln Detect is interesting because it's actually a true vulnerability manager. It's also an update manager, but its real claim to fame is a vulnerability manager. So it will find programs that has security vulnerabilities for which a patch is available to fix it. And so I highly recommend that people check out one or more of those and make sure you keep all of your software up to date. Now, I will say that the solution was found on this one, and in this particular case, it was a notification from a site and going in, just disabling the notifications from that particular site in India, all of the pop-ups went away. So this problem was solved, but this is a generic sort of issue, and so I would suggest anybody, consider what you would do in addition to anything that I would say. Or did I say something wrong? You can write in suggestions into the chat tonight or follow up by sending in something in the suggestion box at opcug.ca, and we can add to our body of knowledge of what to do in cases like this. I see that Stu said, don't forget updates through the Microsoft Store. Microsoft Store should do its own updating automatically. I think in the early days, you had to actually turn it on. I think by default, the store apps do update automatically. But it's not a bad idea to go periodically into the Microsoft Store and take a look at the updates and see if there are any that haven't been getting updated automatically.
In most browsers, at least that I've seen, if you look in the settings, there's a way to turn off pop-up. So check your browser settings as well.
Yep. Yeah, for sure. Tim said, what was the name of the website? I presume you mean the website that was causing the updates. I don't know. It was the .co.in, but I don't know what the actual site was. But this is one of the things that he noticed, that the pop-ups all had indication that it was .co.in, and pop-up notifications were enabled for that site. And so he was pretty sure that that's what it was, and he just disabled the pop-ups from or notifications from that site, and his problem went away. And what, Alan, you say, what's the context of what?
Well, I was wondering what he said, what was the name of the website? I was wondering what he meant.
I presume, Tim, that you were saying about the, in the pop-up that this person was getting?
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
I should have said that website, maybe.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, so I think we can carry on. That's all that I see in the chat right now, so I'll keep monitoring that, and we'll cycle back to it at the end of Q&A. And again, if anybody has any other ideas, by all means, throw them into an email to suggestion box, and we can build up our arsenal of tools against malicious stuff.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. Right, so moving along, Tom has a follow-up to his AutoHotkey presentation he gave a couple of weeks ago, and today he's going to talk about scripting. So you're going to share your screen, I imagine, Tom. And unmute your mic. There we go.
Yes, I'll share my screen. I presume you can all see it now.
Yes, we can.
AutoHotkey, your personal automation engine. So you get to tell the computer what to do, Roland. Let's see. Okay, so this is a reason to use AutoHotkey. If you have a sequence of things that you're doing repetitively every day or every hour or every 3 minutes, then AutoHotkey is good for that. And there are, if you look in the corner here, this actually, the presentation was generated by Notebook LM. So they gave me a whole bunch of fancy stuff. So what happens, how does AutoHotkey work? You specify triggers, which could be a hot key or a hot string. Then there are actions that you can do, like clicking the mouse, keystrokes, running program, doing a whole bunch of stuff. And then the context. This is where you're activating the particular hot key. And that you can, in the scripting, in the script, you can actually specify it only works in these particular windows or situations. So you have a sanity check that it doesn't, it won't then happen in any situation if you press the key by accident. So your first view, this is the simple one. You put in the way that you build a script is by creating a new file that ends in .aht, and you put in a text, and in this case it's colon colon btw colon colon by the way. So what this says is that if someone types in btw, replace it by the way. So the hot string, this btw is the trigger, and it replaces the text with by the way. You can also launch a program. You can open a website. Notice that there's a special character here before the end. So that means that you're using the control N as the website. That little caret means that it's a control. So if you type in the caret, and then when you your actual trigger becomes the control N. And here it's the hash mark. And that's a symbol for the Windows key. Wouldn't you know? And in this case, the Windows key is Win plus G at the same time. And it would create, open this website at Google. So building a workflow, you can actually have a whole bunch of actions in the thing. And the way you group those actions together, so that Control Q here does the actions, is by these squiggly braces. And it will do this action and then that action. Send actually sends you, it actually sent it as a typed message as to wherever you are. And message box makes a little box like this. So you type in the text and then you say script. And then each command needs to be on a separate line. And you can add intelligence, which is, this script is a form of programming. It's not just sequences of letters or commands. You can actually have loops and if-then-elses. So in this case, this slide shows an if-when active. So in other words, if-when active, and the title of that window is untitled notepad. I like this one. Then, the thing you're going to do is send, put in the message box. You're going to show the message box. You press Alt Q in, and then you send Notepad. Obviously, it didn't show it there. And everywhere else, if you click it in a browser or something, or some other program, then it will show this. You would press Alt Q in any other window. So in this thing, it's doing it only when you're in the notepad, and this is doing it only when you aren't in the notepad. And you can use a macro recorder to generate complex actions. So sometimes it's easier to actually show AutoHotKey what you want it to do. So you record the macro, and then you can perform the macro. In other words, you go ahead and do things. You put in keys, you move your cursor around, and so on. And then it will generate the particular commands that will go in the AHK file. In this case, click there, click on 123, comma 456, and then send some text, and then type some text in, and then click another place to go to on your screen. And so that's often a good way to start off creating a macro for something that's common for you. But it will need massaging, I can promise you. Oh, by the way, go back here. The way you create a macro of the site editor, I will show you, which is SCITE4 AutoHotKey. includes a macro recorder for doing things like this. The modern engine, there's two versions of AutoHawk, the version 1 and the version 2. They're very creative there. And some of the scripts you may want to use are old scripts that are using version 1. But version 2 is a much safer way to decode things. It's much simpler to understand, and it's easier to use. So these are some of the differences between a consistent NIC. Everything is a function, et cetera, et cetera. We shouldn't need to worry about those details. But there is a version 1 and a version 2, and I would suggest always using the version 2. So, your architect's vision, you're the architect, and you can build custom GUI tools. You can build things where you have windows that do things in it and do all kinds of things. So there is a way to actually create an application by yourself using an auto hotkey, if you so desire. That seems to be quite ambitious. The integrator's version, well, that's where you get to play with other people's windows. So you want to, instead of doing the multiple, for example, crossing multiple windows, pasting, copying here, pasting there, and doing other stuff like that, you create a hotkey that does that. You bring up the, it can even bring up the windows, position them, and then do the action you want it to do. Or for that matter, if you have one thing open and you want to do something that involves four or five different keys or actions like typing in particular text or other stuff like that, you can do it all in a hotkey macro and do it with one key. So you don't have to wait for a developer to add a feature. Or if without a hotkey, you can modify the behavior of the program to fit your needs perfectly, almost perfectly, huh? Get access to a universal customization layer for your entire Windows environment. That's the ambitious version. It's often very difficult and painful, but that you will find out if you start coding in C or Rust or Python. You'll find that it's like chess. All the basics are easy. You can see where everything goes. And everything is simple until you start putting all this stuff together to actually get something done. So programming is like chess. Your blueprint. How do you start off at this? The easiest editor to use for this, NERD is very nicely. It's built especially for AHK. All these things, syntax highlighting. If you start typing a command, it will give you the choice of all the commands that begin with those letters. You have an output panel that shows where what your errors are. You can press F1 on any command to open its documentation. I suggest using this as your initial editor for any auto hotkey macros or scripts. And your starter template, this is the recommended settings for all V2 scripts. Requires hotkey version 2, like O. Single instance 4, so you only have one instance of your script running at once. And your working directory, that's mainly if you're linking to other scripts. And where the files are. So it requires single instance, etc. The script to application. For yourself, you can just run the scripts. And the way you run the scripts is you start off auto hotkey. Usually I have it in my start folder. And then you just, to run the script, you just click on these, double click on the script, or type it into your run, or your start. And you just run that script. In fact, you can have multiple scripts. And they all, the AHK will bring up the auto hotkey environment and start it off. But you can also share your creations and put them in a .exe file, which is a standalone application. It's sort of AutoHotkey is all included in that. So you finalize your script and you know that it's working. Then you right-click the file in Windows Explorer, or you can do this in SciCheck, in that SciCheck for AutoHotkey editor. And you can create an executable file that you actually create an .exe file. You can find a lot of resources for AutoHotkey. I think it's AutoHotkey.com. Just search for it, you'll find it. So there's official documentation. There are official AFA forums. There's a massive repository of solved problems and advanced scripts. And in fact, there's one of these forums there is actual scripts that people have posted there. And I think that there's thousands of them. But there are also YouTube channels and books and blogs that you can look at to figure out how to actually accomplish what you want to get done. So you are the architect. Let's go back. I want to do a demo. And to do that, this is the editor. So this is a particular... this is the SciTech SciTE4 AutoHotkey editor. I have five files open in it, and this is one that I've written. And this is a I've found that sometimes when you're in some programs, those programs will take your carriage return and do different things. And for example, if you're running and you're putting in a comment in Facebook, and you copy in something that has carriage returns in it, it will create a different comment for every carriage return. In Bridgebase Online, sometimes I want to send a message mail to someone. And if I open but it's limited to like 243 characters. And often I want to send them a whole bunch of things, more than that. So I can use this to actually send it to them, and the carriage return gets interpreted as sending that particular message, that particular line, to the source and to the destination that I want to send it to. So this is a very simple one. This is Control Alt Shift D for date, and send mode is input. This is a little faster than other kinds of sending stuff. I can set tier delay, no hold down period. In other words, you can have hold downs and stuff like that. So this does it the fastest. I set a variable. This is the assignment character, colon equals. So I have a variable called date string, and it formats the current time. This is A now, current time, in this format, YYYY, month, month, day, HHMM. So this capital H's are for 24 hours. So this will actually create this particular thing here. And in fact, I can put it in again. I can run this. Control Shift Alt D. I could run, but I can't apparently. But I did that to run this. And the reason I put that, I want that date to be there. Sometimes I want it as part of a file name, which is why I'm using hyphens and underlines, no colons. Sometimes I want it just to be in a particular file that I edited or something like that, within the date time. Another one that I created. Oh, sorry, that was the date time. I was talking about pasting wrong. This is where I was what I was talking about before, where you want to paste multiple lines when a simple paste messes things up. Also, as you can see here, I've used, this is the star, slash, star, and star, slash. This is all a comment. But semicolon is also a comment if it's at the beginning of a line. And I believe in version 2, you can also type in slash, slash. It will also be a comment. And at the end of the line, similar to the semicolon. Let's process set high priority high, send mode input. Set key delay to 1, so it's a very small delay. And then I send text A clipboard. This is a built-in variable, just like A now was before. A clipboard is the current clipboard. And then after I send that, because I press these things down, I want to make sure that I send them up. So I send Alt up, Control up, and Shift up. And they're in the curly brackets, because those are particular TVs, references to particular TVs. There are more complicated things. This is a version 1 macro. And this will actually create a log file of all your window titles along with the time and how long you were there as well. And this goes on and on and on. And it's about 5,000, well, it's about 800 lines. So there are a variety of things that you can do, and these are the version 1 thing. There's A now, so some things are carried over from version 1 to version 2, like A now. But it can open files, it can read the files, it can do a whole lot of things. There's another one here. It's a version 2, AHK auto hotkey. And this is, again, these are comments because of the semicolon. Send input, send those input for click. This is how you accept clicks, how you accept clicks and keystrokes, I believe, too. Basic errors and variables and amazing. It's smaller like that. And if you can set up all things, you can set up variables, letters, and, you can set up it's actually a vector, so that is not a string. There's a difference in programming languages. So these are A, B, C, D, E, up to I, and so on. And it goes on and on and on. And if I go to the end, this is these 5,000 lines. But this is one of the things I found in the forums, that you can actually solve Sudokus, or you can create Sudokus with this, and you can create easy ones or hard ones just by deciding what you want and clicking it. So if you're a Sudoku lover and you want new Sudokus every minute, you can have them, and then you can work on them and solve them in this program. So you can write complicated programs, and as you can see, there are a variety of indents and places for curly brackets and things like that that people usually use to make sure their program is actually readable when they go back to it. So now you are the architect. So basically you can try things out. You can do little things, you can do big things, but anytime you have a list of things that you want to do over and over again, auto hotkey is the place to start. And that's it. Are there any questions?
I don't see anything in the chat.
Okay, so thank you very much. Thank you very much, Tom. Okay, so next up I have a YouTube tech share. And as you know, I really like these historical YouTube videos, and this one is basically all about Python, how it was developed and how it's working today even. And it's quite a long documentary. It's actually almost an hour and a half, but it's really quite interesting. So if you have any interest in Python, it's really a neat video to see how things actually developed. Okay, Chris, we had a question about smart TVs.
Yeah, so this came in. Somebody had a problem with a smart TV that had been working fine for a long, long time. And it was just after a period of time, all of a sudden, one of the services, Apple TV, said, Apple TV cannot find the internet, or the TV said that. And could still work with everything else. Everything else in the house was able to still access Apple TV. And rebooting the router didn't help. Restarting the TV didn't help. Checked various settings in the TV itself. And it says internet not connected, but it was able to access YouTube and things like that. So there was all kinds of problems. Turns out he got it solved. I got an email just today on this one, and they reset the router and the TV box remotely when they call Rogers. And he says that what he thinks really fixed the problem was that cleared the cache. So going to settings, privacy, locally stored data, and then he's able to get the Apple TV login screen and log into the site. And he says he had to also enter his ID and passwords for Netflix and Amazon Prime, which I guess was because all of the cache information got cleared out. So he says, yeah, just like everything else on a PC, turn it off and turn it back on again, flush the cache. So it, the problem was solved. If anybody has a similar sort of problem, take a look at that as being a possible solution for you.
And Tom's got a note here that he had a Bell gigahertz modem which went bad and they had to replace it. So, but he says the tech help was very good.
Oh, Simon just plugged in that if you do have to talk to Rogers, he says it was really hard to find the phone number for Rogers, so he has pasted that into the chat if anybody's trying to get tech support from Rogers.
Yeah, put it on a sticky note and stick it on the back of your router.
Yes, right. I find it's on your bill if you get from Rogers anyways. It always has the phone number for tech support is in the bill.
Oh, okay. Okay, all right. So we were talking before we started the meeting about uses for artificial intelligence chatbots. And Jeff Dubois sent this one in, which he says, you know, he likes to go find recipes on websites, but generally they're quite complicated with all kinds of extraneous stuff. So he basically asked ChatGPT to extract just the recipe from the page, get rid of all the junk, and then now he has a recipe that he can actually follow. So he hasn't actually verified that it works, but I think it actually does. So his example was looking for a recipe for butternut squash soup, and he found the first hit in Google was for this Love and Lennon's website. And you can see that there's a big title here, and there's some text, and there's some graphics here, and more graphics over there, adverts down the bottom. And all we were looking for is somewhere in the middle of all those adverts, and there's even got a video running down here in the corner. And what we really want is this text right here, which tells us the ingredients. And then somewhere further down, it will tell us how to actually make the soup using those ingredients. So Jeff says he asked ChatGPT to just extract the recipe, gave it the URL, and it says, okay, here's the recipe from the page you linked, just the ingredients and the instructions. And sure enough, if you look at the text there, that's what you've got. You've got a list of ingredients and a list of instructions. Kind of go a bit mad on the references, I think. There seems to be a link on every line for the Love and Lemons website. I'm not quite sure what they're for, but they'd be easy enough to get rid of in a text editor. And Chris was mentioning earlier that you often get suggestions at the bottom of the page what else it might do for you. And here it's saying, I can give you nutritional information, serving suggestions, or tell you how to make it ahead of time or freeze it. So as Jeff says, what he really likes is he can very easily extract just the text, the ingredients, and the instructions, put it into a Word document, and then print it, and he doesn't have to bother with all the extraneous stuff. And he can make the text bigger and that kind of stuff. So there's a classic Jeffism. It makes it super simple to extract your recipes from websites. So there's a good tip for Christmas fare, I guess. Okay, previously we've been doing a bunch of computer basics things, and I've been going through a list of apps, and I've asked people, what apps do you find useful? And lo and behold, I got an answer here from Bill. Now, Bill actually uses an Android tablet. He's going away from Windows laptops. And I think I saw him on the call just earlier, so he's likely plugged in his tablet right now. And because of that, all his favorite apps, of course, are for Android. Most of them come from the Play Store, One is actually open source, and you can get it from GitHub or from the developer's website directly. So here are Bill's suggestions. He likes NocoPrint because it makes it very easy to print documents from his tablet. All you need is an on-the-go adapter, and you plug that in between the tablet and the printer. The app is ad-supported, but that's usually not a big deal. Seems to work with most printers, and he really finds it very useful. So I guess previously he was using Windows to print things. Now he doesn't need to do that. Here's a neat one, a program called House Sigma Canada, an app for Android. If you want to check on your neighbors and what they're selling their houses for, you can use this app, and it basically links into presumably the real estate information. And you can do the video tour of the property, but it also gives you the price and all that kind of good stuff. So Bill says he knows somebody, supposedly the better half, who likes to snoop around using this thing. That's, if you're interested in local house prices, might be an app for you. And we've talked about Gas Buddy before. Tells you the local prices of gas and gives you the kind of top 10 or whatever. And Bill says he likes to keep track of the ongoing price. But actually, he goes and visits his friends, as he says, which is a nearby reserve because gas there is tax-free and it's always cheaper, whatever Gas Buddy says. And Bill is also a big music fan. He likes Shazam, which is interesting because if you have a song but you don't know the title or who the artist was, if you run it through Shazam and play the song to it, it will actually tell you. Because as he says, you can even hum or sing the song to it, and it will name that tune. That's going back a while. And then finally, he's got this YTDL NIS, which is a video downloader. So you've got Facebook videos or YouTube videos. And he says this one helps when other apps fail to do the download. He says he's not sure what it was, but I checked with one of the bots, and it says YTDL is a YouTube downloader. It's an open source video downloader. And it's been modified by somebody called Dennis something or other, and the DNIS basically comes from Dennis, so it's a bit of a play on words there. Anyway, those are Bill's favorite apps for Android. My question is, what are your favorite apps? What are your favorite apps for Windows, favorite apps for Linux, or favorite apps for Android? So send us some information, and we'll have your favorite apps next time, maybe. okay. Part two of creating PowerPoint presentations. We're going to look at how to create slides, how to move them around, and how to keep slides for reuse. And I just mentioned that in part one, I'd said that you could use one of these shapes and use Control-Alt-Drag to make it bigger and keep its shape. And I was thinking that was wrong when I said that. And sure enough, it's Control-Shift-Drag. So you click on one of the handles, use Control-Shift, and then drag, and that will make the circle a perfect circle as you make it either bigger or smaller. And Chris tells me that you can use the same technique for any of those shapes to make them bigger and just retain the proportions, as it were. All right, so supposing we want to create a group of slides which are basically all the same. I often do this in slide presentations. I'll create a slide and then I'll use it as kind of a secondary template, if you like, and create multiple slides of the same type. And I especially do this if I'm going to use a blank slide to just put a graphic into. So here's a presentation I'm working on one of these days, the dark web, and I've created a series of slides there. But supposing I've got a presentation like this one, and I've got a blank slide here, and I decide, well, I'm going to put in like four graphics in a row here. So I'd really like four or eight or 16 blank slides. So if I select this blank slide, I click on it, and then and use the left shift, control left shift, and just drag the slide and drop it, I'll get a copy of that slide. So now I've got two slides. So now I can just select both of them, control click, I've got two slides, I drag those to the right and drop them, and now I've got four slides. And I can just rinse and repeat. I can get 8 and then 16, and then I've got my basis for my blank slides for my whole presentation. So it's a real quick way to generate a bunch of similar slides. And if I didn't want to move the slides in a presentation, then I use a similar technique. I use just drag and drop. So if I've got a single slide I want to move somewhere, I just select it with left click and then drag it to some new location, and that will actually move that slide from one location to the next. However, if I do that with multiple slides, so I select them using control and left click, then it drags all the slides and it takes them. Sorry, left click actually creates a copy, right? So you get a copy, whereas control and left click will actually do a move. So, and here's an example in this presentation right here where we've got Bill's computer, basics, his most used apps, and I decided that I selected them all, they're all selected with a red box here. Instead of having them come after this business of PowerPoint, I actually wanted to move them before. So I've highlighted them all. I use control, and then I start to drag. They're all dragging up the screen here. And then I let them go right here, and now they're positioned after my Python slide. And so you can see that by using control and left click, I've actually moved that whole group of slides from one location in the presentation to another. Another interesting technique is that you can actually take a slide and just duplicate it. And this is quite often the way that I'll do build type slides. Rather than create builds, I'll create my last slide first and then duplicate it multiple times and get rid of certain elements. But in this case, I've got a slide which is more or less in the format I want, but I want to create four or five slides in the same kind of format. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to choose my slide, and I'm going to go to the View menu, Slide Sorter, and the Home tab, and then go New Slide, and then Duplicate Select Slides. So I get two slides exactly the same. So now here's my base slide. I've got a title, I've got a graphic, and I've got a link. I do that View the Slide. I select the slide. I go up here to New Slide. And then in this window here, I choose Duplicate Selected Slides. And that gives me a second slide, which looks exactly like the first. So now I can take the second slide, and basically I can change the title. So instead of whatever it was, right now it says Audacity. I delete the graphic, and I paste in a new graphic. And then I change the link to be something other than VideoLand. And now I've got a new slide, which is the slide which promotes Audacity. And so duplicating slides with very similar content makes developing slides very quick. And even quicker is to retain a bunch of slides that you might want to use some other time. So here I've got this file called Q&A add-ons, and you probably see some of these slides that you've seen once in a while now and then. Every now and then I'll pick up this idea generator slide and the second one right here. I'll grab those two, drop it in the deck, and then I'll remind you of all the things that we'd like you to do for us at some other time. So use a stash, a library of slides that you might want to use at another time. So next time we're going to have a look at that menu of shapes. So we look at text boxes and shapes and graphics and how we incorporate those into slideshows. All right, we must be in the, yes, we're in the next 10, in the next 5 actually. So I don't know, have we got any other questions, Chris?
Nothing new in the questions.
Okay, well let's carry on then because we've got a lot of wrap-up stuff here. First up, presentations in conjunction with the library. Chris is taking a few days off by the look of it, because all of the presentations coming up in the next little while are by Linda Buskey. So if you want to take a trip to Iceland without leaving your living room, then she's got one of her armchair travel series at Nepean Center Point on January 17th. If you want to make hard copy photo books for gifts or for coffee tables, then Ruth Dickinson on January the 20th. And then another armchair travel, the Danube, must be a river cruise, at Centennial on the 22nd. And as usual, if you want to see more presentations, they're all listed on the library's website. And if you want to attend any of them, then you have to register with the library to reserve your spot. Okay. Chris has got a follow-up on that.
Yeah, just before we get to that, Mafo had a question about MS Office licensing. And so when he was on Best Buy site, it had an option outside of Best Buy, and it had a site called Proper Keys where you could get license keys. And if anybody has any experience with that, you could muted. Okay. anybody has any experience with that site, chime in on the chat. And Jen had December 17th, what software is the bookmaking using? I don't know what that is about. So if you want to clarify on that. And Richard asked, will Techniques also work in LibreOffice Impress? I guess a lot of them will, Alan, but I don't think all of them would translate, eh?
Sorry, what's the
Whether LibreOffice Impress will use the same techniques as you're showing in PowerPoint?
I think it probably does, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of them would, for
I
sure.
I can't think of anything that doesn't at the moment, but I don't use Impress that much because you love PowerPoint so much and they're really not compatible.
Yeah. Okay, we are coming up to the close, so let me just finish up with this. We decided that we might have some bonus presentations. So Linda, our membership chair, had this brilliant idea. Why don't we offer ad hoc additional presentations beyond what we've got on Wednesday nights? So I want them not offered as, the subjects that are not offered as regular monthly presentations, and they might be inappropriate for various reasons. We want to have them on nights other than Wednesday so they don't conflict with regular programming. And we want to have them on Zoom, of course, so you can enjoy from the comfort of your home. And no registration required. So basically what we're planning on doing is having these extra presentations. We'll advertise them, and then if anybody shows up, we'll carry on. If nobody shows up, the host will close off the Zoom session. So how you find them, if you go to the OPCEG website, and there is one there now, so you go there, go to upcoming events, and then you could just look through chronological order of all the events, or if you select from the categories box bonus, then it'll filter out all of the other events other than these bonus presentations. And each is going to have a unique URL, so it won't be the same URL that we're using for our regular meetings. The link will be listed in the event listing, and it'll have the long Zoom URL, and typically we will also make a tiny URL link that is a little bit more user-friendly. We'll advertise all of these presentations in both the monthly meetings and QA meetings, and we will also announce them through the announcement email distribution list. So those are the parameters, and just to kick things off to see whether we're going to be successful with this, Linda is going to give her how to take better vacation photos. And this one, the description there, it's all about how you can take better travel photos. And you don't have to have a dedicated camera. Most of the techniques that she's going to be talking about are available in cell phones, tablets, or regular cameras. It's going to be on Thursday, January 8th, 7 p.m. And it'll be about an hour long. And then where? Well, it's going to be hosted on Zoom. So the tiny URL for it is tinyurl.com/opcug-bonus01. You see that I'm hopeful that we're going to get up to beyond 10, I guess, or beyond 9. And then there is be the long link there. So if you go to the upcoming events, you'll see this particular event is listed there. So we're not sure whether there's going to be real interest in this. We're looking at them. There'll be various days. They won't always be on a Thursday. And there'll be all kinds of different topics. And we'll just see if it works. And if it's successful, we'll keep it going. If nobody shows up for them, we'll stop offering them.
I was asking if it's members only for these bonus sessions.
Nope. No, I think like all our meetings, if we can spread the word about them, great. And anybody who shows up can attend.
Natalie wants to know if it's the same presentation as the one Linda's given at OPL. I imagine yes.
It'll be very similar. It probably is not going to be identical. Her program on better vacation photos at the library is, I think, about an hour and a half long, so she's going to pare it down a little bit. I know she is working on some new content for it, so it won't be identical, but it'll be very, very similar.
Okay, and Jen has her hand up. So, Jen, what's your question?
My question was for Linda. Is she at the library, is she giving this bookmaking presentation using a certain software or using PowerPoint or using...
This is making photo books. Yeah, okay. It's all done on the web, and the one that she uses is Photo Books Canada, but other sites have very similar tools available, but it is all web-based.
Thank you.
Okay, so I think we're in the home stretch here. So, Chris, this is your slide, I think.
Yeah, okay. So, we're going to be on a bit of a hiatus. We decided that people are probably not going to want to attend on December 24th, which is our next Wednesday. And so we will not have Q&A that night. And this slide was created by Alan. So likewise, on December 31st, we decided that we will not have a Q&A on New Year's Eve. And so that means that the next Q&A is going to be January 7th.
And talking about AI and what its uses, that was actually produced by Bing Image Generator. AI can be very useful. Okay, last thing we have is... because we're not going to be meeting until the new year, we have to give you a list of New Year's resolutions. So first of all, if you're not a member, you have to join OPCUG because, as Chris said, we have a special offer. So if you give us $20, which is the one-year membership fee, we will give you a second membership year absolutely free. And if you are a member, do not send us any money. You're going to get a membership year free extension anyway. As Chris said, everybody who's a member in good standing on March 31st will just have their membership automatically renewed for another year. So that's the board's Christmas present to all current members. And second resolution is send your computer-related question to suggestionbox@opcug.ca. We've had lots of questions in the last few years, but we can always use more. We love getting questions, especially ones we can't answer, because then we ask you what the answer is. And then you can share your favorite computer app for your PC or an Android phone or tablet or Linux. If you have a particular app that you find really useful, other people would probably find it useful too, so think about doing a small share on how it works. We like to get Loony Links, links to websites with Canadian content or YouTube videos or YouTube channels that you find of interest, which again are related to computer technology of one kind or another. And we like to promote those to other people as well. And if you want to become an author, if somebody gives you a a fountain pen for Christmas, you should use it to write an article for Ottawa PC News, and Bridget's always looking for new material. And the final thing, just remember that we won't have sessions on Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve, so mark your calendar for 2026 for Wednesday, January the 7th. And then we have a really special offer. If you're thinking about you'd like to promote an application or talk about a technical concept or some kind of thing that you found that you think is interesting for other people, but you're not really good at producing PowerPoint slides, for example. And Chris and I, we've done a few PowerPoint presentations in our lives, and we're prepared to help you. So here you have a couple of mentors who will help you produce a share for a future Q&A, or we could help you produce a complete regular meeting presentation of an hour and a half. And if you need any help, just send us an email and we'll see what we can do to help. Finally, on behalf of the board, we wish everybody a Merry Christmas. And just one final note that we won't be meeting on the 24th or the 31st, so send your questions and your shares to suggestion box or our Q&A session on January the 7th. And send your request for assistance with PowerPoint to either Chris or myself. So that is your whole list of resolutions. Hope you wrote them all down. You started to check them off. So until January the 7th, I hope everybody has really good holidays, and we'll see you next year.
Thank you all for your participation this year. It's been great, and you've all made it a pleasure to contribute to the running of the group.